Bettering your business takes working with the best. With the James Hardie Alliance, you gain access to leads, training, networking, and support from the number one brand of siding in North America. Achieve new levels of success by joining the James Hardie Alliance today.
Travolting presents Bobbin for Robin. Hosted by Jeff Sweeney and Stuart Elmore. Covering the final cut with special guest Sam Kelly. All right. So if this were like a Black Mirror episode, this movie.
Yeah.
But this is a Black Mirror episode.
But it's a shitty Black Mirror episode. If this was like a good Black Mirror episode, Robin would see.
It would have made sense.
It would have made sense.
Like, what's it? The Secret History of You is this movie, but without an editor, right? Yeah. With Tony Kibble.
You know what this movie kind of is? It's like The Secret History of You. It's also like, has anyone ever seen Strange Days, the Catherine Bigelow movie? It's one of my five favorite movies. It's like this 1995,
I haven't pulled up
sci-fi, like near history crime film in Los Angeles.
Is this when she's still married to James Cameron?
James Cameron writes the movie and produces it. It's his best script he's ever written.
Mm-hmm.
But she directs it, and she's a better director of action than he is.
Oh, by like, I will miles. Say. Although to be fair,
I love James Cameron. To be clear,
yeah.
But like. The combo of the two of them is incredible. Strange is a movie about, like, essentially there's an implant called a squid that you put on your head, and when it's on your head, it can record your memories. And then Ray Fiennes is playing, like, a slummy, like, memory dealer. He's like, you want to be a woman for a day? You want to sleep with a guy? I can be a guy. I can hit you up. I'm the Santa of the subconscious.
Is this like Inception-esque though, where they just put the memory on and experience it, and that's it?
They put the memory on, they experience it, and the movie is ultimately about like living in the past and not going forward,
which is literally what this entire movie is about.
It's like and all I could think about was Strange Days watching this, because like Strange Days, like I said, is one of my favorite movies. It's so good, and that movie has like the budget and scale. I'm gonna show you guys the teaser for Strange Days because it's like one of my favorite things. It's so bizarre.
Are you connected to the board?
I connected to the board. Yeah.
Have you ever jacked in? Have you ever wire tripped? No? A virgin brain. Well, we're gonna start you off right. This isn't like TV only better. This is life. Yeah, that's a piece of somebody's life. Pure and uncut. Straight from the cerebral cortex.
Dude, these titles
you're
are there. Killing me.
You're doing it. Seeing it. Hearing it. You're feeling it. It's about the stuff that you can't have.
Not enough drop shadow.
Like running into a liquor store with a .357 Magnum
forbidden
in your hand.
Forbidden fruit.
Feeling the adrenaline pumping.
Adrenaline.
Make it happen. I can get you anything you want. You just have to talk to me. Talk to me. I am your priest. I am your shrink. I am your main connection to the switchboard of souls. I'm the magic man. The Santa Claus of the subconscious. You say it. You even think it. You ain't have it. Are we beginning to see the possibilities here?
It's I kind of can't believe that's Ray Fiennes.
It's
the so hair.
He has never done another movie performance like this. It's so strange.
Yeah.
That does not represent the tone of the movie at all, but I do think that trailer is crazy.
Yeah,
and I wanted
that's
to
a
share.
Crazy trailer.
Just imagine you sitting in theater in that place.
His character name in that movie is Lenny Nero, which is talk about a really good fucking bad guy name. Is he the bad guy in the movie?
He's the hero. He's the main character.
It seems like he'd be like a bad guy.
I watch Strange Days every New Year's Eve. It's set on New Year's. It's truly just like a movie that at the end of it, you're just like, this is a fucking movie. Type deal. But I kept thinking about it during this movie, to get back to the point, because that's a movie that's about the same concept of reliving memories and, you know, what is like, what do you leave behind? What is their perception of you? Is it, you know, there's like Ray Fiennes' character essentially edits all these videos of a relationship he used to be in, all these memories, and like kind of paints this beautiful picture of this relationship they had. And then as the movie goes on, he realizes it was never that, which is the exact same thing this movie is doing.
Well, that's
where it's like you can erase certain memories of a person and tailor that, like, their legacy to what you want it to be.
This movie really feels like it's trying to say something, because I feel like
it keeps trying
on like three separate occasions. Mm-hmm. He's accused of like cleaning up the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Culminating in that big fight scene, or fight scene, I should say, with air quotes.
Yeah.
But like, ultimately, it doesn't say anything. Like, we just keep saying that over and over again and getting nowhere.
Jeff. I'm going to let this sit in silence. Jeff shamefully cleans up his spilled espresso.
Should we aim the mic at his napkin?
I think so. You come into my home.
I drank about half of it already, so it's like, I don't feel that.
At least you didn't get any on the fabric.
Milka would murder me.
All right. If it's just on the wood, it's fine. Obviously, yeah.
It's actually adding a nice liqueur to it.
Get the fuck out of my house. Yeah, this movie's trying to say a lot of things without actually saying anything, because none of the focus points of this movie ever come to an interesting conclusion.
I would argue that this movie doesn't really come, like, it does literally come to a conclusion, but it doesn't come to any conclusion that had any meaning. I guess the quest that we started 90
what was
minutes
the quest?
Ago
yeah.
was, you know, I guess, what are the implications of this technology? And what we end at is this like murky area where people still like the Zoe implant, like, and it, people don't.
It turned into like a murder mystery crime thriller.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the part where like 40 minutes of the movie, I'm just lost, because I thought I was watching a movie about like some sci-fi technology they were going to spend a lot of time on.
Mm-hmm.
And the catalyst of said plot is this technology, but then it almost seems like the plot that takes place after said catalyst wants nothing to do with the technology.
I kind of like, actually, in this movie that the movie's not about iCorp, right? Mm-hmm. It's about like this implant that they made and how Robin Williams is struggling with an inability to reconcile his past, which just turns out that
he just has the wrong memory.
Like, this whole fucking time, he just like misremembered these weird details that like I don't think normal people would have forgotten. Like,
yeah,
it's the right move of the movie to not really be about the technology. It's the same thing as Strange Days does, where like that movie's not about the squid. The squid is just a tool within the movie.
Yeah,
but my ultimate thing about the final cut is, and you guys, I have no evidence of this. I am like kind of curious: was this movie finished? Like, did they shoot the whole movie?
I think they did.
Because there's like, it feels like there's chunks that are just missing from this.
Yeah.
What I would bet happened is that this movie was 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And they showed it to a bunch of test audiences, and people were like, what the fuck is this?
People were probably falling asleep in the theater.
Yeah, because it's a boring movie.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
For being 90 minutes long, the second act of it feels like it's 2 hours.
Yeah.
It starts off strong. Like, we see the
inciting
incident.
I'm into the first 15 to 20 minutes.
And then we see sort of like the blow up with Delia later.
Yeah.
Which pushes us to the conclusion, like, those are the two points where everything is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And just about everything in between, like the interpersonal dynamics between like Cutter to Cutter or Cutter to Fletcher, are just like so uninteresting.
Uninteresting. And like, I feel like I'm just missing like large, like, relationship beats and like certain elements, because I really don't know what the main story of this movie is. Because on one end you're like, it's about the, what's the guy who he's making the movie for, his name,
oh,
Charles something,
Charles Bannister. At one point I'm like, okay, this movie's about like Charles Bannister exposing, like looking through his memories to expose like a corporate thing, a corporate malfeasance, but that's not really what it's about. I'm like, well, oh, it's about him trying to prove that he didn't kill this person as a kid and like meet them in the future. I'm like, oh, well, it's not about that either. It's like, so wait, what is the movie about?
Then it's about like, did this guy like molest his daughter? And then it's like, nope, we don't care about that plot point. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, is there like a conspiracy with iCorp and like the Cutters having implants? Nope, it's not about that either. Like, I watched this movie twice for this podcast. Jeff, when have I ever willingly give up that much time to watch a movie twice to better understand it for this podcast?
Not very often.
I watched this the first time, I think it was like Wednesday or Thursday. I watched it for the first time.
Watched Thursday, yeah.
And I fell asleep throughout a lot of this movie, could not pay attention. I was very distracted as well, so I didn't really give it that much benefit. But movie also didn't try that hard to keep me engaged either. So then I thought, okay, well, like, do I just like kind of wing it Saturday and go off the Wikipedia, or do I try to give it another go and like rewatch and see if I can like pick up on the things I lost? So I went ahead and rewatched it last night, and oh my God, I did not like the one thing it helped watching a second time was I agree with what you guys said. The first act is pretty okay. I won't even go as far as to say the first act's great. I'll just say the first act is followable.
I like, do think it's, it might be the best part of the movie, I think, yeah, is the first act, which is so sad that it's also like mediocre.
It's a solid shit while the rest of the movie is liquid shit.
If the whole movie continues with like the relative quality of the first act, this is probably like a 6 or a 7 out of 10. Like,
agreed.
Like,
agreed.
Pretty like,
yeah.
Watch it, like
gentleman 6, gentleman 7.
This movie, like a central issue I kept noticing is the movie doesn't have the budget for its like, its expectations of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell this movie's made for very cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If mainly like what my biggest tell was when there's the protest.
Yeah.
And there's like 15 people in the protest. Yeah. So I'm like, this movie has a very small budget.
Yeah.
Because it's like mostly all set in like hallways. Yeah. Like the woods.
Hallways and rooms and like small rooms and things like that.
I feel like we should drop a quick summary of this movie because I guarantee most people.
The summary might confuse
them. Good luck. I would say good fucking luck.
Essentially, I guess what I would boil it down to is, I mean, you know, feel free to tell me if I'm wrong. I would really love, I've seen this movie like half a dozen times. I really like it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's good.
I really like this movie. I don't think
it's very good.
I know. It's a contradiction.
But no, I know.
Wow. This is a disaster.
I like it because, like, well, first, it's a movie about an editor, and we never get movies about us.
That's essentially why you're here, is this movie about an editor, right?
Yeah. And
same as an editor.
I do think that Robin Williams simply being in the movie does a considerable amount of heavy lifting.
Yes.
Like, yeah. That's why he's in this movie, right? It's because this movie wasn't going to go anywhere with just Jim Caviezel.
Yeah.
That's how you say his name, right?
I think so.
Which, on a side note, why does that dude's beard always look like it's fake? I have never seen him.
It's his soy boy energy.
I've just like, never seen him and been like, that beard isn't glued to his face.
I'm trying to think. We've covered him on Thin Red Line.
We covered him on Thin Red Line. That's the only time we've talked about Jim Caviezel. Our Sound of Freedom episode 4.
Please have me for that one.
You know what's weird? Just quick segue. Is this movie stars, obviously Robin Williams, but the like number 2 and number 3 are Jim Caviezel and Mira Sorvino.
Yeah.
The stars of Sound of Freedom are Jim Caviezel and Mira Sorvino. And I was just like, oh, is there something? Like, are they married? Are they like friends in life?
It's the Final Cut cinematic universe.
And I'm like, is Jim Caviezel like, I mean, I know he's like kind of like a extremely far right guy.
He's a QAnoner.
He's a QAnoner. Holy shit. I was like, is Mira Sorvino in that too? And is that like they did Sound of Freedom together? Did they meet on this movie? Like, what's the connection? As there's literally no connection. It just so happens that they wound up being in this and that together.
Yeah.
Complete coincidence.
But anyways, the summary, right, is Robin Williams plays a guy named, what's his, Alan Hackman, H-A-K-M-A-N.
Different than Alan Parrish.
They really.
Very different Alan.
They really were just like, how can we double down on like the editing motif, right? His last name's Hackman. He was quite literally born for this. And he's a guy whose job it is to edit. We see at one point, he gets like 580,000 like life hours worth of video, and his job is sort of to cut people's lives down into 2-hour rememories, and sort of the movie's about the implications of that on him rather than the implications of that on society and sort of like the rabbit hole that he goes down. But it's like and you're like, okay, that sounds cool, right? It's a
good
guy
pitch.
I mean, the camera's in people's eyes and he cuts their lives. Like, what is that? And it ends up just like devolving into the most bizarre exploration of editing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And they show, and like we were saying, you know, this is one, it's not a well-edited movie.
Yeah, no, it's not. No. That's the main problem here.
It like, and so much of its like emotional beats are carried by this one theme that plays every time he plays a rememory. And it's funny too, because they spend so much of the movie being like, these are long. Like people come, it's like an experience. You're going to watch like the one battle after another of Jeff Sweeney's life, right? Like, what does that look like? It could be 2 hours, could be three. And everything he shows Delia is like
a minute and a half,
maybe 90 seconds.
And he's showing like teaser trailers. Like, yeah, what's the bit here? Like,
also that, like, so does he cut like a quick teaser of your life? And he's like, hey guys, you know, you are going to be so excited when you see the final product. It was scored by Howard Shore.
To talk about like the ethics of this job and like the philosophy of it, it's like, I almost feel like it's in the same category of being like a wedding videographer.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
I mean, like
but for death?
Very, very loosely.
Yeah.
Because a wedding videographer witnesses everything that they show, right?
Yeah.
But Robin Williams witnesses everything secondhand. So it would be like if you hired
a wedding editor.
It would be like if you hired James Cameron's production company to shoot a wedding.
Yeah.
And then were hired after the fact to sort of piece that together.
But, yeah.
But you didn't get any, you didn't get a script. You get no script notes. You get nothing. He just gives you a hard drive.
Yeah.
They do have like a meeting with like one of the loved ones before he cuts it together. Yeah, I think.
He interviews like the family.
He gets
but that's it.
Yeah.
And they don't really even, they're not really even able to, in the, when he talks to Bannister's wife, she's able to give him like a vague memory or vague time frame. And he still has to go search for it.
And most of the discussion is like, is there anything that I'm going to see that you don't want me to put on screen?
Yeah.
Because you might as well tell me now because I'm going to know everything.
Yeah.
Which is like, I'm like, what? Why? It, in a world where this technology exists, I'm thinking too hard about it, but like there would be the technology to like auto edit it all down.
So the problem is that the movie doesn't give you anything to think about. And so as it was,
you think about all the wrong things.
It gives you like, you're not watching it wondering the ramifications because it like kind of whacks you over the head with them.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the first thing he shows the rememory to the brother and then the brother's like, this is how he should be remembered. And then Robin Williams is like, I have to watch this domestic violence scene one more time. And you're just like, I mean, like, it's like low key, I don't want to call it traumatic, but like, it's not fun for me to listen to someone scream for help.
Yeah.
Right.
And like, Robin Williams is just like watching it
in
its entirety.
He's desensitized.
Until he deletes it. And it is because he's desensitized, but it offers him no value.
Yeah.
Right. And it isn't until he's watching the Bannister video when he makes the most, I mean, you guys wear glasses, right?
Yeah.
No? You sometimes clean them with your shirt.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen someone clean something with their glasses with their shirt and been like, wow, that could be Stuart? Like, I don't understand the leap of logic that he makes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
The whole thing with what's his name? Louis.
Louis. Yeah.
Louis is baffling in this movie. I simply don't get why this is the plot point. Because like, why is the guy alive in the present? Like, what is the value of him being alive in the present? And then realizing he's actually dead at the end anyway. Because
that part confused me. I didn't know.
I kind of want to table it for a second because we should quickly talk about the Robin Williams of this all, the context.
Yes.
Yes,
there is some.
Yeah, Stuart, you should hit us with the context
Robin. When I say there's some.
But we're coming back to Lewis.
it all starts with the director, actually, Omar Naim. Who I believe is Lebanese.
Yes, he's Lebanese.
And this is their first, like, this is like their directorial debut, basically. And it shows. It's their first script. And he submitted it to a bunch of different, like, screenwriting programs and competitions. And it got picked up. He gets an agent, starts getting shopped around, lands in the lap of Robin Williams' desk. And Robin Williams decides, like, that he wants to play this role. And I think also we talked about this earlier, how in the course of Robin Williams' career, we're coming off the tail end of like what we call Robin's like evil trilogy, which basically, Sam, to kind of just like fill you in. So like after the Oscar win of Good Will Hunting, he gets like essentially like three blank check movies: Patch Adams, Jacob the Liar, and Bicentennial Man. All of which
I do love Bicentennial Man.
All of which don't do well at the box office, I will say. Opinions aside, they don't do well in the box office, but also to that degree, particularly with like Patch Adams and Jacob the Liar, because I think Bicentennial Man, at the very least, I can say like it has the same symptom of the other two movies, but I think Bicentennial Man has a lot of other cushioning around it to not make it so obvious. Mm-hmm. And that symptom is Robin's overt sappiness is starting to like coat the screen too much. And sure. So Patch Adams, big flop, and but makes a lot of money. Jacob the Liar doesn't make a lot of money, and it's a big flop. Bicentennial Man, I think Bicentennial Man still made a good amount of money.
Bicentennial Man is a flop.
A financial flop?
I believe so. From
I thought about. It was like a mild flop.
It's not like a mega flop.
No.
It's
not, Jacob the Liar, though, and all this to be said, a lot of the negative reviews come from the side of like, Robin Williams thinks he can fix a movie or make a movie good by simply just being like lovable.
Stop. I can only get so erect.
Look at a picture of Robin Williams in the Bicentennial
Man suit. The robot, yeah.
Oh my God.
Why'd they put my man in the suit?
So he decides he's going to pivot and he says, okay, if the overtly like warm, loving, sappy character isn't working for people, then I'm going to go.
I'm going to be sad and somber in the corner for 90 minutes. Sad and somber. Yeah.
Exactly. So he starts off with 1 hour photo, which is a good movie. Mm-hmm. Then Death to Smoochie, which is not a good movie, but like Robin still plays like kind of an evil character in that movie. Insomnia, which we talked about like a couple weeks back. Good movie. Robin does really well personifying a very manipulative, twisted like killer. And while, like, at least 1 hour photo Insomnia, he gets praises for those performances, I think, and we never actually, like, really hammered this home, Jeff, but, like, I think it's, like, Robin isn't, like, the number one flattering component of the movie. It's, like, either 1 hour photo, I mean, he is, but 1 hour photo doesn't, like, it doesn't make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Like, it comes out, it gets good reviews, but, like, not a lot of people go and watch it. So that kind of goes under the radar. Death to Smoochie. Edward Norton is the number one of that movie, really. So he doesn't get noticed too much. And then Insomnia.
Have you seen Death to Smoochie?
No, I have not.
You would probably like Death to Smoochie.
Death to Smoochie is, it's like Robin Williams is the number one credited actor on it. He's, like, in the credits. Robin Williams. He's gone for functionally 40 to 50% of that movie.
Yeah, like, it's all Edward
Norton.
He's
in the opening scene. He's in the scene immediately following the opening scene.
Yeah.
And then Edward Norton is in probably about 45 minutes of the movie with no Robin Williams aside from like two quick pop-ins. And then Robin Williams takes on like a co-lead role for the second half. It's insane.
Yeah. But then Insomnia comes out, and while he's good in Insomnia, a lot of the praises is on Christopher Nolan for his second movie and Al Pacino.
I was just about to say if that was the Al Pacino movie. I have seen that.
That's a movie about Sleepy Pacino.
I forgot Robin Williams was in that.
He plays like
that's my point. That's my point.
It's like he's good at it, but it's not like anyone's like walking out of Insomnia, like with their main takeaway being Robin Williams should play more serial killers.
And so I think to that degree, we're reaching a point where Robin is now like
I don't want to use the term washed up, but
he's getting
I don't want to use that
he's
term.
He's getting very close to that, like because now with Final Cut, like he's picking a script that he thinks is like interesting. It's a unique concept.
This movie's
he's
a very small budget.
Putting a lot of trust on like a first time director. Mm-hmm.
And it is an interesting subject.
Yes.
That's why, it's that's a very why interesting pitch. I watched it in the beginning. And I was also on this kick where, you know, I feel like there was this like small window of time where comedic actors were releasing serious movies,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like the number 23.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm here to see like, what's the other stuff you do when I'm not laughing with you?
Yeah. Yeah. I found Robin very like, I'm trying to think of the word where it's like, I found Robin in this movie very like strange. Not and like this is the only performance like this that he does in his career.
Yeah,
because like even in Insomnia and 1 Hour Photo, where they're more serious movies, he still kind of like has a bit. His performance in this is essentially like harkening back to like very like you know low energy 70s performances.
It is, and it's also delivered, though, with the same, like, the same cadence that he uses to deliver his jokes.
Yeah.
he uses to deliver his lines in this movie, but they're like somber instead.
Yeah.
And you're like, it's really, really weird to hear what normally would lead me into a punchline.
Yeah.
Because he's still like, he still does like a little bit of the fast talking, but it's a little more measured and a little bit more like, I'm going to put some of my acting like chops into this. And what you get is this really, really bizarre performance of like, where you're like, maybe there's a joke somewhere and that never comes.
Like, this is like a noir-esque performance from Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And that I found just like, I think he is quite good in this movie. I'm going to say, I really liked his performance in this.
Didn't actually. I
think it's strange because he never does anything like this before or after.
Yeah.
So it just feels so kind of disjointed with the rest of his filmography.
Yeah.
And that's what's interesting about it. Like, when Jim Carrey pivots into doing serious stuff, he's still kind of playing Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like when Robin Williams has pivoted into serious stuff prior, like, whether it's Good Will Hunting, Dead Poets Society, 1 Hour Photo.
It's still Robin Williams.
It's still Robin Williams. This is the only performance I've seen where he's not playing Robin Williams.
Not one laugh, like the whole movie.
Not one laugh the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it just kind of feels like, I'm trying to think of an actor who I can compare his performance to, but it kind of feels like he just walks in and is delivering like a very like subdued, it's very subdued is I think the best word I'd use
so
for it.
I agree. It is subdued. And nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a cut. I agree with you, Sam, 100%, that I think there is an original 2.5 hour cut of this movie.
There has to be.
Because when I'm watching this movie with Rob Williams, I agree. He plays this subdued like part very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like I get anything else. And I feel like that it's, again, going to the part that I think we're missing pieces of the movie, that there's like climaxes and conclusions and switching points of the movie where his performance doesn't read the way I feel like it should have read if I'm following the story as it's going. Because like, when does he find out that Lewis is actually still dead?
Oh, he talks to the daughter and she's like, oh, that's Lewis. He was my teacher. And then he's like, oh, like what'd it do? Where's he at? And she's like, oh, he's dead. He died in a car crash. So it's when he first has the interview with Bannister's daughter, and she gives him that information. But like Jeff was saying earlier, what was the value to killing Lewis, resurrecting him,
and then killing him
off screen, and then resurrecting him in the end of the movie, to showing the resurrection in the end of the movie, right?
Because this...
My only point in that was to say that like I could not have read that from a fucking mile away, that reveal of like, oh, thank goodness, like the guy I thought was dead is actually dead. So is that easier on him? Is it harder on him? Like, I couldn't tell because it feels very one note to me.
Because for the listener at home, the movie starts with like a flashback. This movie's shot by Tak Fujimoto, who's Jonathan Demme's guy. He's also M. Night Shyamalan's guy at the beginning of his career. Extremely accomplished DP. I do think he makes a lot out of a little in this movie. Like, as I keep saying, you can tell this movie doesn't really have a high budget. There's a few sequences where he's doing some really interesting stuff with the camera, I still feel like.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to credit Tak to that.
Do you think that they saved money by not having to color correct the flashback sequences? Because entirely in log.
Yeah, they're just like raw imagery.
Yeah.
But so they did it starts with a flashback of two kids playing at like an abandoned factory in the middle of nowhere.
Playing marbles, yeah.
Playing marbles.
Things that kids do.
Which I feel like is supposed to mean something.
You would think.
Why did they choose marbles? And so I'm thinking about that. I'm writing it down. And then they just, nothing like, I couldn't think of, like, it just seemed pointless. Yeah.
And so they're playing, and then there's like a plank of wood across a big gap in the ground.
They're playing, they decide, they're playing, we find out that Lewis lives in that area.
Yeah.
Alan is visiting. He's leaving later that day with his family, which is important because
it's important context.
Because when they end up walking around, then they go to this factory where they discover the ravine, which is like 20 feet,
like a silo down. Essentially. And so the young Robin Williams like crosses the board and eggs the other kid Lewis to follow him. Lewis gets like 5 feet from the other side. He goes, I can't do it, and then it's like and then jumps for the side for no discernible reason.
Yes.
And he's like, no!
After saying his legs don't work.
Yeah.
Because he's terrified. So then he leaps.
At that point, jump forward, further along down the plank. Like, it might not have worked, but...
He does jump slightly to the right.
He jumps off the plank to the right. It's crazy. Why would you do that? It's a deeply deranged decision. But he's like, and he falls and dies. Young Robin Williams runs down the stairs, and he finds him in a puddle of blood. He steps on the blood. This important detail. He steps on the blood, leaves bloody footprints, and, you know, runs away because he's terrified. He's lived with this guilt his entire life. Then we get the opening credits, which I want to quickly talk about before we jump back to the Lewis thing.
Oh, that I did have a comment on the
bus
credits.
And truck ass font. Like, what is going on?
This is like fucking the first Resident Evil movie font or some bullshit.
First off, that, and it also feels
Microsoft
like,
Word type shit.
Dude, and it was such a long opening sequence. I might contradict myself a little bit here, but... So I do feel that the movie was originally longer and cut down. And then I feel like it was cut down to be so short that they were like, in order to be respected, it almost feels like they had to cross the 90-minute mark. And so they make this like 3-minute insane opening sequence that like at a certain point, it's just words moving around a screen. And it's like giving you everyone, like the entire end credits feels like it's in the beginning.
It's like, company grip. Wait a second. What's going on here?
And it's like, I feel like Omar Name is listed like 5 times in the opening credits, like directed by Omar Name. And then there's a few other credits. Written by Omar Name.
You guys ever
Name.
Seen
few
Mr.
Credits,
Bean's super... Holiday?
No.
It's like a joke in it where Willem Dafoe is playing a prominent actor director.
So they put the name everywhere.
And so his end credit, like he's premiering his movie at the Cannes Film Festival. And of course, Mr. Bean shows up and causes chaos. But like, it's just Willem Dafoe like on an escalator, and it's just a shot of his face going up the escalator. And it's like starring Willem Dafoe, written by Willem Dafoe, edited by Willem Dafoe, produced by Willem Dafoe, directed by. It's that energy, except it's Omar Name, who's not a big name.
It's really funny going to film school and then sort of like watching the things that we all did wrong in film school just show up in a Hollywood movie. Like this shit, they really did film school. Omar Name is everywhere.
Yes.
And then the credits, of course, they end with, you know, a movie by Omar Name, written and directed by Omar Name. Yeah. And you're like, I remember this.
I've seen this. I did this.
Yep.
Now it's like you want the least amount of credits as possible. It's like, credit me for the thing I did.
unless it's James Bond or Mission Impossible, just start the fucking movie.
Yeah.
Like, show me nice wide shots of the area we're going to be in and slowly move in and tell me who's in the movie. I don't need to go through this weird like animated sequence for 2.5 minutes or 3 or 5 minutes.
The movie came in under 90. God damn it.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. It's like, it's an hour 29. Let's pad it. You know, let's squeeze a little bit extra in there.
Yeah.
But to get back to the Lewis thing, like, cause there's that opening credits and then like, cause we were talking about Lewis, like, The plot is he's feeling guilt over the death of this kid from his childhood. He's never gotten over it. And he's
the death he probably could have prevented.
And he didn't, you know, do anything to help him.
Literally closes his eyes until Lewis falls. Until he hears the thud.
And now he lives this life of just in memories instead of moving forward. And he finds out that Lewis, it might still be alive.
Yes.
Off of a random memory from Bannister.
He sees a guy. So he sees when Lewis is first introduced to him, he witnesses this child take his glasses off and clean them with the lower right part of his shirt.
A thing I do all the time.
A thing people with glasses have done since the invention
of the shirt.
Of the shirt. Yeah. Which obviously came second.
People were wearing glasses to shirtless for
they were just
eons.
Wiping them on their sweaty bodies. Yeah. Unable to see.
Why didn't it work?
The oils of my skin.
And it's like,
have you ever gotten like skin oil on your glasses? The worst thing in the world.
I do this all the time. I poke my
eye. You have to like run it under a sink essentially to like get that shit out of there.
Damn.
With your perfect 20/20 vision.
You rat bastard.
Never needed glasses. Never needed braces.
I went for 12 years of my life not having glasses until I went to a baseball game with my dad. And he's like, hey, look at the score. And I said, I can't tell what the score is. And he's like, oh, so you can't see that? And I'm like, no. And he's like, how long have you been living like this? And I'm like, I don't know. I just can't read anything at school. And he's like, why didn't you tell us this?
I was 16. I was sitting in the back of my algebra class and my teachers, all those markers ran out. So we started writing in yellow. And all of a sudden I was like, well, I can't see that. Because like the yellow was blending in with the yellow of the fluorescent lights.
Yeah.
And so I went to the eye doctor. They were like, you have the slightest nearsightedness. Mm-hmm. And I put on glasses and I went outside, and it turns out that trees in the distance are not supposed to be blurry. And I didn't know this. Yeah. I just assumed that because it was far away,
yeah, you were,
I like, had weak human eyesight. And when I got close, I would understand the full shape of the thing. And it turned out that like you should be able to see the trees 300 feet away.
That's the craziest thing when you first hear it. I was like, oh, wait, this is what it's supposed to look like.
I just, you're telling me now for the first time.
I had no idea.
But yeah, he... So
crazy. Don't know what that's like.
Robin becomes... Maybe we just like go through the plot sequentially and we'll get back to
the
We
got to talk about
thing.
The Cutter's Code, guys.
We got to talk about the Cutter's Code. Okay.
Which I have a question about.
Quick segue. One of my favorite segments on the show is opening up IMDb trivia and finding the deranged shit that people write in there.
I love the
Because like IMDb
shit.
Trivia is just user submitted and they will put the dumbest things in there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
One of my favorites. In this movie, Robin Williams is bound by the three codes from the Cutter's Code. 5 years prior to this movie, the character he portrayed was bound by the three laws of robotics and Bicentennial Man. That's not a fun fact.
It's funny because we were sitting here talking about I'm like looking at the rules and I was thinking about, well, that's kind of like Isaac Asimov's rules. Yeah. And then it made me think, well, those are kind of like the rules that the plurbs seem to use in Pluribus.
Yeah.
Is Pluribus good? I think Pluribus really good.
Pluribus is fucking fantastic. And it has the three rules aren't written, but they do seem to follow loosely the three rules of robotics.
Yeah.
Anyways, you should watch it. It's great. You love sci-fi.
I do love sci-fi. Robin Williams also played a lead character named Alan and shared the role with a child actor who played Alan's younger self in Jumanji, 1995.
See, I agree. That's not a fun fact.
That's not a fun fact. That's a coincidence.
Wow. That's crazy.
It's so weird that two writers in Hollywood chose generic white people names for their white characters.
Yeah.
Who saw that coming?
Robin Williams looks like an Alan. Right?
Yeah. I do actually kind of think he does look like an Alan.
He does look like an Alan. Yeah. And Alan Parrish is very fitting for Robin Williams.
Yeah.
The Cutter's Code.
Yes.
Number one. Or you want to go?
No, I have summaries. You have a real one. So.
I just have it in front of me on the IMDb trivia. Cutter Code number one. A cutter cannot sell or give away Zoe. Is it Zoe or Zoe?
I think Zoe.
I've always said Zoe.
Okay.
And that's the implant that allows you to record your memories to your, through your eyes. Yeah.
Something gets said off screen that like Zoes are biologically organic. That goes into
so they're virtually undetectable.
Babies' brains and they grow with the child. Basically, it's not like Elon's microchip Neuralink bullshit thing.
It's said that line is delivered during Robin Williams's crash out when it's basically a montage of him leaning up against buildings, just like so upset with his revelation.
Yeah. And so it cannot sell or give away Zoe footage. So when a cutter being like the editor for the said person,
he works in the memory business. Mm-hmm.
They couldn't think of any better name than Cutter.
I kind of love it because like we call ourselves cutters. And they were like, no, that's works for Hollywood.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it work for this? And then they change everything else. Like the Kino becomes a guillotine, which is such a weird, morbid thing to call the thing you use to restore people.
I do like the guillotine is the name for it because it's like a film cutter. But
it's a wooden Kino. Yeah.
But also like, you know, it's killing people. It's dead bodies. Yeah. I do like guillotine as the name for it.
I'm not opposed to it. And I do think the best and only interesting edit in the movie involves the guillotine. He goes to iTech and he gets the little thing. And as he opens up his laptop, it cuts to him. He starts to open it at iCorp. And when he's home, it then cuts to him opening it at the guillotine and it transports us to locations. Yeah. And I was like, that was fucking sick.
It's a good edit.
And it's the only good edit in that entire movie.
It's a great cut. I actually clocked that too. I'm like, oh yeah.
I wrote it down because I thought it was so cool.
But yeah, and they essentially can't sell or give away the footage. So if you have a client, a dead guy, you grab their footage, can't sell or give it away. Mm. I don't know. That's that.
Them's the shakes.
That's them shakes. Number two, a cutter cannot have a Zoe implant, which won't be important. The movie.
Which makes sense because then you would be releasing other people's memories.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you perceive them.
Yeah. Like if you die and then you're a client, then somebody can look at your memories and see
other people's
footage that you cut. And then it'd be a, and then that person, if they had an implant and they died and somebody looks at their footage, then they're seeing footage of a cutter's life, looking at footage of a cutter's life and footage of a cutter's life. It's the cutter paradox. Mm.
Which actually we do explore.
Which we kind of explore a little bit. Yeah. Just a little bit though. And then number three, a cutter cannot mix Zoe footage from different lives for a remembering.
Which interestingly is the only of these three guns that does not go off in this movie.
Yeah, well, it never gets brought up.
I like that it's there to sort of flesh out the universe. I don't like that they introduce the cutter's code and they don't tell us if this is just something that cutters are agreeing to ethically.
Or if it's a law.
Or if it's a law. Or if it's a rule. And that comes into play later, and it's like sort of an inexplicable plot point.
Yeah. Because the cutter's code is brought up, and then, like you said, later in the movie, there's someone who's like, you broke the cutter's code, and you expect like this is going to be a major plot point.
You can never cut again.
You can never cut again. But that ends up not being important, because they let him do the thing he's doing anyway.
They let him finish the task.
They let him finish the task, and then he dies. Spoiler. But,
yeah, I guess like my beef with it is so, you know, we learn the cutter's code, we move along with the movie, and at what, like he gets this banister job, and then that's when shit starts to hit the fan. That's when we meet Fletcher, Jim Caviezel's character. And then it's sort of like through this exploration that it's through, sorry, this pressure from Fletcher on the outside to get the footage, and Robin Williams is like, dire need to find out if Lewis is still alive, what his name is, who he is, where he is. That sort of like pushes us to find out that Robin Williams has a Zoe implant.
Yes.
And
he finds his own records while trying to find Lewis's,
which is like so convenient that they're in the same box that iTech, which is this massive company.
And he didn't know that he had a Zoe implant.
He didn't know that he had it. Because we learned that you are supposed to tell your child between no later than the age of 21 that they have a Zoe implant.
Why?
And just because...
Just like hours of masturbation from their teenage years.
I was like, from Robin Williams has seen so many teenagers crank their hogs.
He's just sitting there like...
Fucking nuts, dude. And it's all POV, too. Like, anyways, so... Like, he's looking in the box. He doesn't find that his friend Lewis has this implant, but he finds his own file and he steals it. And what's so confusing, the biggest plot hole for me in this movie, I still like this movie. I want the record to show. although I do not think it is good. which, to be fair, is the same thing I feel I said about Swordfish. 10 out of 10 would watch it.
Swordfish kind of good as hell. This is Robin Williams watching all the videos. And he was like, really, from like 12 to 18. He's just sitting there like...
But,
you know, I can eat a peach for hours.
Yeah.
But if like, I don't know, if I worked in an industry that cut footage like this, it's so bizarre. So he has to go to iCorp to get the thing. And that's when he like starts to edit it. Turns out there's only one copy of it, which is like, there's no, it's like iCorp, right? I keep saying like iTech or whatever.
Yeah, iCorp.
But they have no redundancy, which will come up later. But anyway, so he becomes a cutter having a Zoe implant. Yeah. We find out his parents died when he was young, probably around 10 or 12. So he doesn't know he has one.
He was never
one.
Told.
And then he enters this industry and you would think that...
They would test you for it. They'd screen you.
Yeah. Well, you would think that if you got this job there, you know, somebody would reach out to...
Let you know.
To iCorp and say, hey, you know, this guy... is editing, does he have a Zoe, and just no one fucking does that.
Yeah, it just never happened. Like, I am willing to accept certain, like, there are plot conveniences that you have to accept as a movie viewer. Like, movies by
there wouldn't be a movie.
Movies by their nature are, like, going to always require a certain level of suspension disbelief and a certain acceptance of coincidence. Mm-hmm. It's how movies work. It's how they exist. There are certain strands in movies that do strain credulity.
Yeah.
And I think this almost reaches that point. It kind of doesn't go over it because the rest of the movie is so you have bigger fish to fry when you're thinking about the problems with this movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's not really the major issue, but it's like there should be like an offhanded line where they're like the company does not publicly like put out this information. The only people who know are the parents.
See, I think that they could have solved that by in the later in the movie when she's like, you know, you can never cut again.
Yeah.
If she had just clarified and been like, you know, like I know it's not law, but you can never cut again.
Yeah.
Ethically speaking, you violated the code,
yeah.
even though the code isn't something set in stone.
Yeah.
And then we could be like, oh, okay, so of course iTech isn't looking into
yeah,
them.
It's like, just why like would a they? Thing. It's just like it's a, you know, it's an honor code system.
But instead we're just left with this like murky world of like, who made the rules?
Yeah, what are
and
the
why
rules?
Does nobody enforce them except for another cutter?
Ill-conceived.
Yeah, it's just like, it's. I mean, and he could have chosen not to tell them and continued to cut and nobody would have ever known.
Yeah. Because like this movie begs to have like to be set in a near future world that like actually feels like the near future, because the movie doesn't feel like it's set in the near future.
No, it's just now. Or it was 20 years ago.
It feels
but
like
with,
2005
with one extra technology.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like this movie almost begs to be set in like the world of like AI artificial intelligence or something.
Yeah.
Where like the early parts were just like. Yeah, there's like kind of a crazy looking, like most things kind of look the same, but there's like a crazy looking car that goes by or like
billboards are holographic.
Billboards
are
holographic.
Yeah. Telltale sign. The phones like, are of a weird screen.
Like a Blade Runner-esque world.
No, yeah. Cyberpunk.
Yeah, cyberpunk.
Yeah.
It kind of begs to be in that kind of world.
Yeah.
Obviously, the budgetary constraints prevent that.
Yeah.
Which
honestly, I don't think hurts it.
It doesn't hurt it. It is just like
hurts it. The right.
It's like you can, if this movie had a bigger budget, it still wouldn't work because the script is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But if this movie, like, let's say, you know, Omar Naeem like has an uncle who's like a trillionaire or something.
Yeah.
And he just like gets enough money and this movie like kind of looks crazy and Rob Williams like has a little hover car he's flying around in. I do think it adds a certain degree of like zhuzh to this movie.
Yeah.
That would help it.
Yeah.
Because when you're just dealing with this one technology, but and they like keep trying to throw in like, well, there's like a crazy tattoo community and they have put on tattoos that erase the Zoes.
Yeah. And oh, I love like, that to stop the audio, he gets a 3D tattoo of a pause sign. And I was just like sitting on my couch, just like
vibrating.
Trying not to vomit from laughter because it's just so
fucking
like,
idiot.
I was like, it's that simple. And now I'm like, yeah. I wish I could have seen what the no video tattoo was.
Right.
Like, it's like the square for the stop button.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm like, what could they have come up with as silly as that?
But like what is the of the three like main plots? What's the first one that really comes up?
The rich executive who dies that hires
Bannister.
Him. Right.
The first Bannister. Main plot point is getting signed by Bannister's widow and then getting approached by Jim Caviezel to purchase the footage,
yeah.
which Robin Williams vehemently says he will not do.
Yes.
Yeah. Which leads you to assume
he's an I-Corp executive, right?
He's the lead I-Corp lawyer.
Yeah.
And he beat his daughter or
he molested his daughter.
And this is the thing you expect, like, okay, this movie's going to be about like Rob Williams having the ethical dilemma of do I expose someone's privacy
mm-hmm.
for public good or do I stick to my code?
Mm. And what's crazy is not only does he not really stick to his code and not only does he not expose this guy for being
the movie
a piece
doesn't
of
care
shit.
About it.
He spends the entire fucking time focused on one screenshot from a dinner party
yes.
that he happens to run
yes.
into. And it's
oh
like,
my God.
You're like, there's so many ethical implications yes. of this movie. And the only thing you give a fuck about is whether this guy lived or died.
This guy molesting his daughter should not be a plot point in this movie. Jim Caviezel should want the stuff because he's like, he looked at all of the like,
which
the
is what I thought it was going to be
should,
about.
It should just simply be like, this guy was an exec. And he looked at a bunch of, you know, mm-hmm. I-Corp documents. If I get a hold of them, I can expose like the
fraud of the industry.
The fraud of the industry.
Here's an easy Simple. One. Here's a super quick easy one that I don't think the movie doesn't really do. It's like, oh yeah, I-Corp are looking at everybody's memories like yeah. wirelessly.
Yeah.
And they're like just something like easy, something yeah. easy that's like, oh, like if we blow the lid on this conspiracy, it'll shut down the implant system yeah. for good. Like
if this movie was made in 2025, it like that's exactly what it would be about is how Palantir is watching all of your memories.
Yes.
Okay. But like this movie was made in 2004 after the Patriot Act. Like,
I know. And this guy has no concept of surveillance.
I'm just like, what? It's right in front of you guys. Like,
but instead, like, because if it's that, then there is like almost an understandable ethical dilemma in it.
Okay.
Like Robin having to decide between like his code of privacy or like the privacy of the country, for lack of a better
term. Yeah.
That's like an idea. Because as it currently stands, his thing is exposing a guy for molesting his daughter or keeping his job.
See,
and I'm like, that's not an ethical dilemma.
That's not an ethical dilemma.
That is, there's one correct thing to do here.
Yeah. What's weird too is I don't think Jim Caviezel is aware of the molestation.
Yeah, no, he just says the guy has a scandal.
I think he's actually looking for what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I think
at one point
files.
Jim Caviezel does say like there's some rumors about him and his daughter.
Oh, okay.
He kind of offhandedly says that.
But like, that's murky though. Jim Caviezel is trying, like, because then why does he then like keep Robin Williams? Why does he keep all the memory footage after Robin Williams dies at the end? Like, there's no like movie where it's like
I'm uploading
the memories to the database news journalist. Like, there's no scene of that. So why did he want the memories? Like, it's not clear. Did we miss something? Did I miss a scene that he destroyed Bannister's memories in the movie? Like,
you did miss a scene because he didn't destroy it.
His partner wife did.
So we're just like introduced to Delia. I love how
she's like 30 years
his
junior.
Twice and are still not quite sure of the major plot points.
Guys,
I'm with you. I get it. I watched this movie forever ago a couple years ago. I was like, I should watch this movie again. And I like forgot about all of the twists. And then, you know, obviously Jeff messaged me and was like, what movie do you want to cover? And I said, you know, Miss Doubtfire. And if possible, let me watch the final cut again.
Yeah. Well, you're an editor. So you're like the person to watch this movie.
Yeah. I'm like, just tell more stories about what interesting things we don't have to say. Yeah. and
remember how much Mrs. Doubtfire stressed me out.
Yeah,
I still sometimes like wake up in a cold sweat.
I got a friend who started listening to all of the episodes that I was on, and he did Mrs. Doubtfire first, and he's like, "You guys spent like an hour talking about anything like basically except the movie."
We get criticized on that all the time.
We did have a 999% increase in new listeners this year.
What I love is that we're doing it again right now.
You know who our biggest criticism of that is, Jeff?
Who?
Your father.
It's my dad. Yeah.
I love that.
My dad's always like, you gotta stay more focused. He's probably listening right now. Like, ah!
He listened to Dudley Do Right as well, and was because he like unironically loves that movie.
Hell yeah.
And again, was like, you guys spend so little time actually discussing the thing about the movie.
It depends
like.
If the movie's good.
Yeah,
that's true.
If the movie,
we did
good,
a 4-hour episode on AI, artificial intelligence.
Amazing.
But 2 hours of that was about just actual AI.
Yeah.
Which kind like, of on topic still.
Kind of on topic still. But like, yeah, with this, which is a problem with this movie doesn't know how to stay on topic.
Yes.
Because we just got into a whole wormhole about like his wife, Delia.
Not his wife, though.
Or not his wife.
So, Girlfriend. So in like the third scene of the movie or the fourth scene of the movie, he goes to the bookstore, just a bookstore, and he wants to talk to this woman. And this woman is kind of like off-putting to him. And you're like, okay, they've got a complicated relationship, right? And ultimately, like, she feels bad for him because he spends the whole time, like, moping. And she's like, whatever, I'll come hang out with you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then she goes to his house, and that's where she discovers he's a cutter. Something that, like, I guess he had just never brought up before. I don't even know how long they've been seeing each other. For her to be that kind of, like, annoyed with him when he first gets to the bookstore, like, they have to have somewhat of an established relationship.
Yeah.
And she has no clue what he does.
Mm-mm.
And then... like, we jump forward to another scene where she comes over, and again, he's like, I want to show you something. And all of a sudden, it's just not weird that he's a cutter.
That he's
her.
A cutter.
She thinks it's weird he hasn't talked to her in a couple of weeks because he's been on this, like, or I don't even know if it's a couple of weeks, could be a couple of days. Time is so murky in this movie. I don't know how long he's been cutting the Bannister project.
Yeah.
It seems like he went home basically, or he went to iCorp that night, got the drive, went home, plugged it into his guillotine, found Lewis that night. Started searching immediately and was like, I should have an answer in 3 days.
Yeah.
But those 3 days could be a month, and I don't really know.
Yeah.
What I do like about the Brady Bunch sequence in here when he's like looking through all the different files.
Yeah.
And it like, oh, it starts with him, God, in the middle and then it expands into like,
and it's just his eye and yeah, his fingers on the controls.
And it's like various clips and it goes like full Brady Bunch. There's like nine of them. And mm-hmm, for some reason the maid is in the middle. Like, yeah, it's like a bunch of Robins. They do weirdly have.
See, Jeff, you went straight to Brady Bunch. I just went to straight to Keanu Reeves being like, bullshit. You are a product of an equation that to eliminate an anomaly of what we consider, God, a perfect system.
Stuart, can I tell you what you just you mentioning the architect scene of the Matrix Reloaded does to me? This is what that does to me.
Full bast.
Yeah.
Full bast to Jeff.
I will sometimes, if I'm like feeling like stressed, I will just watch the architect scene from The Matrix Reloaded because it is so soothing listening to that guy just be like, you were an equation. You were the solution to an equation. We have destroyed Zion six times before,
and we have become exceedingly efficient.
No, you're putting too much we have become exceedingly efficient at it.
You got to get like the lower tone because it's a little breathy.
Efficient at
we
it.
Have become exceeding like it is like a little breathy when he says it. Exceedingly efficient at it.
But like you're putting too much in.
I am.
It is a perfect performance.
Yeah.
Not to drag us back on topic. Not to host this show, but guys, welcome to Travolting presenting Bopping with Robin. These are my guests, Stuart and Jeff. Soon we'll talk about Mission Impossible, but anyways. No, but like we have that conversation when he first, after or before he meets with Delia, not his wife, he goes to the place where editors hang out.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, cutters hang out.
Some sort of club.
And it appears to be a club like for rich people.
Yes.
But there's like no one there and nobody's rich. And Robin Williams rides the bus, even though his fee for cutting, especially because they established early on that he cuts only the dark shit.
Yes.
Cutters will get footage. They'll see abuse and be like, nope, I'm not taking this job. Give it to Alan Hackman.
This is another thing where it's like, you can tell there's problems with the budget of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can tell like, there was just like not a lot of thought put into the expanding just the simple act of consequence within a movie.
So I don't think this was a budgetary decision. I think it was the tool that they used to introduce the tattooed people.
Yes.
It's a bad tool, but it works.
Yeah, they could just simply have been at the protest.
I agree.
Because like when you think about a movie, like you do have to think about consequence.
Mm-hmm.
And what does A, if you pick A, what does A mean for B? And what does B mean for C at the end of your movie? Because
mm-hmm,
it's like, okay, we are establishing that Robin Williams is the cutter for only the dark shit and all the rich people hire him.
Yeah.
Ergo, you don't have to say he's rich.
But he drives a
Rolls
Royce.
He should be comfortable.
But he doesn't drive a Rolls Royce.
He takes the bus. And I'm like, okay, why does he take the bus? Is it because he has a problem with money? No. So, but he has a very fancy setup. So he does clearly have wealth if he has this nice fancy setup,
mm-hmm,
but he's taking the bus and he's running into these people, but he hangs out in a nice club. There's just no communication between all the different aspects of his character.
Yeah.
And so you're just kind of like, where is he in the status of this world?
Yes. And then like he meets these other cutters, a cutter and two assistants. And one of the assistants is like, you know, I really would like to run this new sorting program by you. A line that I do not understand because he's like, I have this way to more like efficiently sort material. And maybe it is relevant because later when he goes to sort the material, it can't find Lewis for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But Robin Williams then goes home and plugs in the little drive or whatever. And the guillotine seems to have absolutely no issue sorting footage rather efficiently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I got dailies and every time, and I was running through the dailies, for those of you who aren't in film, dailies are the footage that you get after something is shot. They come to the editor, we watch them, and then start picking our shots. If my fucking Avid announced every category of scene that something was in, like I would lose my fucking mind. Yeah. Like
it's a setting you turn off pretty quickly.
And I know that it's a movie, and it's just easier to explain things. Yeah. And that's part of the suspension of disbelief we were talking about, right? Like this wouldn't exist in real life, but I'm going to give it to you because you have to make it easier for me to understand. But holy shit. And it's just like announcing every category. Yeah. And at no point in time does it does mention masturbation, doesn't it?
It does.
Okay.
This is like the one This is like the one instance where I can understand, because if it is like 580,000 hours or whatever, I get it. You need like, you actually do need maybe the AI to sort through this, because you would die before you would finish it.
I wrote down 544,628 life hours.
Yes.
Which is also like, how do you edit that without a sorting program?
Yeah, you definitely need something that can go through that.
And also, if there is a sorting program, like, why doesn't it filter the abuse out?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it can clearly...
you get the categories, the AI makes little categories, and it's just like, loving time with family, dinners,
molesting
vacations,
my daughter,
yeah. Molestations, yeah. Sexual assaults. And you're like, wait a second.
But it seems like, especially based on that the first scene where we see Robin Williams as a cutter, when he shows the first memory, and we then see him watch the footage of the abuse, you're like, it seems like he's like running into that accidentally, and that's how, or maybe he's running, I don't know how he's seeing it, but it seems, it's just like, it's so bizarre the rules that surround how the guillotine works. And then of course it is, the drive gets destroyed when he leaves for a minute, and Delia, who we've spent this whole time wondering, what's her deal? What is her dealia, you know? I'm sorry.
Because when you do introduce like future tech in a movie, mm-hmm. you kind of have to make the choice. Am I going to explain all of this? In which case it has to be airtight. Or you can just say, I'm not going to explain this. You were just going to understand how, like, the basic result of it.
Yes. And if you start to explain it,
it becomes a problem.
I'm going to start poking holes in it where I see them, which is what we're doing right now, right? Too much was told to us.
Not to like keep bringing up a movie that you guys haven't seen, but like in Strange Days, it's very smart, because it's like the movie never explains what the squid. It's just like, yeah, you put it on, it records your memory, mm-hmm. and then you can watch it on a disc. And that's the total, they never say what company makes it. They never get into how it works. It's just, this is what the thing does. It's great, because you're like, okay, I understand that is the rule of the movie that we're working with. The second the guillotine, they start like getting into the weeds with the guillotine, it's all you can think about. And you're like, well, wait, if this does this, then like, how does it sort this all? And how do you make this like 2-hour movie out of, you know, 586,000 hours?
I also know that like in this universe, people are aware of what a guillotine is, because rememories are like kind of special and unique and rare. But because like he shows Delia and she immediately clocks it. She's like, that's a guillotine. I know what the fuck that is. I have never, ever gone somewhere, and I know the rules are a little different in this universe, in our very real universe. I've never gone somewhere with someone who isn't in film, walked by a kino, and had them go, oh, that's a kino.
That's a kino,
you know what I mean? Like, no one fucking...
Is that an Avatar?
Yeah. Oh, right, exactly. Yeah. I'm like, oh, is that a flame? It just doesn't happen. Yeah. And so I think it's really interesting that she, like, immediately picks up on the thing, which is obviously... It's just to help us as the viewers, like to familiarize how the world is with these machines. But
it's one of those funny things where it's like, within the world of the movie, like this technology that's so ubiquitous in like our lives and our line of work, is suddenly like now the most popular thing within the world of the movie.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when you think about like 20 years ago, the two words operating system. If you went to high school and you mentioned operating system, like people were like, you know, making fun of you for knowing about operating system. And now it's like there's like a TikTok video where it's like update to iOS 17 and here are all the tips and tricks you can learn. It's like this, like technology weirdly does kind of just like start niche and then become popular.
What's funny though is if you said the words operating system today to someone, I do think people would genuinely say, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, they just say OS.
Yeah. You have iOS. To like clearly explain what that device is. I'm thinking now, so that line when he's like, when the assistant says about the new sorting program, I think all that seeks to do, I think I understand it now. It establishes him as like a little bit of a tech head, right?
So that is later when he does the...
When he's like, it's never worked before, and then they just like do it first try.
He's
no
basically
issues.
Playing, what's his name? Who plays Monk?
Oh, yeah, Tony
he's playing Tony Shalhoub in Men in Black, where he has that like machine that brings Tommy Lee Jones's memory back.
Yeah.
Right.
He's basically playing that guy.
I have a question for you guys, though. Like, what was the point, the other assistant, who is like, and who talks to
that guy just sucks.
The other cutter. He does just suck. He's a fucking tool. And he's like, he's literally arguing with the cutter about like things that should be included. And yeah. she makes this line where she's just like, you know, we just make things, our job is to make things look good. Yeah. And he doesn't get that. And I'm like, how could you be interested in this profession and already not understand that? Anyways, so he's like having a bit of a crash out and she like sends him out to buy cigarettes.
This guy does not need to be in this
What
movie.
The fuck is the point of his character? If his character
There's
is,
no point.
It forces her to deliver a line to explain what the cutters do, which is just what Robin Williams has basically been saying to Delia this yeah. entire movie. And we just see it for like a third time. And this kid's like freaking out and looking like that kid from American Horror Story. And that's like all he does.
I think what his purpose in the movie is, and it harkens back to something we were just talking about, is I do think the movie is trying to present Robin Williams as a guy who's extremely successful and makes a lot of money, but doesn't like,
I don't cut with an assistant.
Doesn't care about his yeah. money and like doesn't care about the status of it. Cause this is just his like trauma response is working. In
yeah.
this. Because it's like, I don't have an assistant. I don't have a fancy car. I still take the bus. I think that's what it's trying to do.
Yeah.
Is none of this is communicated well. And so you're...
That's a good theory.
That's my understanding of like why this, what they're trying to do with his character. Like he secretly has like $7 million in the bank, mm-hmm. but he just doesn't use any of it.
Yeah.
He still just like orders pizza at night or something. But the movie, it simply doesn't communicate any of this stuff. And so you're forced to infer that.
Yeah.
On a podcast a day after watching the movie instead yeah. of catching it during the movie itself.
Yeah. And then there's also like right before that kid's crash out, we learn that he was like attacked by the anti-Zoe yeah. thugs.
What are they called? They have like a funny name for those guys.
Oh, I didn't write that down.
I didn't write it down
that
either.
He was attacked. The anti-implant group.
Yeah.
I did write it down.
The anti-implant group.
That are organized by a cutter.
Yes.
And so, that's what it is. Yeah. It's the plot device to...
Yeah, we bring Jim Caviezel in.
It's the plot device to connect Jim Caviezel, who we met at yeah. the first Rememory, and tries to buy the footage. Yeah. It connects him to the group, which I didn't think about.
Notorious Jesus Jim yeah. Caviezel. They recast him for The Passion of the Christ, too. Did you guys hear this?
I did hear that. I really enjoyed Person of Interest, even though it has really high ratings. I didn't actually think it was very good. I don't actually think Jim Caviezel is a very good actor, except in Big Fish.
The three things that Sam has come onto this episode have been like, I really enjoy that. It's not very good, though.
But I mean, like, I was having this conversation with my brother. My brother texted me the other day, and he was like, what's your favorite movie this year? And I was like, well, my favorite movie this year is Friendship, but the best movie I've seen this year is One Battle After Another. And he was like, I don't understand that.
Jim Caviezel's not in Big Fish.
He isn't?
No.
Oh, you know
You're
what?
Thinking of Billy Crudup.
I'm confusing him with Billy Crudup. That's right.
I was just like, wait,
come on, guys. Come on.
That's why I checked.
Like, I did know that. Yeah. But they are very similar.
Yeah.
I
guess. Well, I
Billy Crudup does get killed by an alien, though, so he's got that on Jim Caviezel.
But I do think that there are a lot of things that I enjoy that I know objectively are not a good thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Friendship is quite good.
I didn't have a letterbox until I saw the movie Friendship, and then I made one so I could give it 5 stars because I think it deserves all
of
the
praise. Did you watch the extended Connor O'Malley, Tim Robinson sequence? If you buy...
I'm incredulous now. I did not know that existed.
So I'm going to quickly tell a tale. So I saw Friendship. I really enjoyed it. And A24 has like a fun little Blu-ray like collecting set that they do. And so it's the only way to get a lot of their movies on Blu-ray, and I'm a big disc collector. And so I pre-order Friendship off of the A24 website, and it's going to show up. Shows up when the movie comes out. I'm like, great, put it on the shelf. A big thing they're advertising for it is there is a 12-minute long extended Tim Robinson Connor O'Malley sequence.
That's like literally the only thing that I want in my life is two interacting.
It is just 10 to 12 minutes of the two of them just yelling at each other in the garage. Just of riffing about anything. It is the funniest shit ever. Stuart, there's like in the movie, there's like a sequence where Tim Robinson's just sitting sad in a garage, and then Connor O'Malley comes in and they just yell at each other for like 3 minutes and then he leaves. And the whole time there's just inexplicably a taped up photo of the Situation Room Bin Laden photo on the wall between the two of them for no reason.
It's amazing.
It's a detail. But they put out like the 10-minute one on the disc.
Yeah.
And I'm like, great. And so I watched that. It's very funny. And then I get an email from A24. It's like, our apologies. I'm like, what is this email? So I click on it and it's like, we are so sorry. We believe you were in a small batch of people who accidentally received the toad-free disc edition. We are immediately mailing you a new copy. And so I'm like, what? And it turns out, like, they had, when they announced the disc, they were like, yeah, if you pre-order the disc, you'll get a disc that says Friendship, and it has, like, the toad.
Hell yeah.
It, like, on the disc.
Yeah.
Like, whatever. So I get that my disc doesn't have a toad on it.
Yeah.
And apparently, like, people complained en masse. They're like, we didn't get the toad on the disc! And so I got mailed a second copy of the disc, and it that has the toad on it.
It's a Christmas miracle.
Great. Okay, I now have two copies of this movie. Yeah. I will gladly give you the other one. It won't have, like, a box, but... Jeff,
please. I will happily accept any copies of Friendship.
I will give you the other copy. It doesn't have a box or anything. It'll just be the disc.
Fuck it.
Back to the final cut. I just had to tell... getting the email about, like, we're so sorry you didn't receive the toad edition was such a strange, like, moment.
I love that.
I'm going to jump in here real quick. Sorry, yeah. I don't have a sense of anything in a hot minute. It's been great just listening to you guys talk. A thought that I had a little bit earlier, because you said something, Sam, that made me think of something. You said, like, when we were making the bit about, like, yes, and I'm hosting this podcast, and this is Justin and Stuart Elmore. We'll talk in a little bit. We'll talk about Mission Impossible. And it was when you said Mission Impossible that made me think, what if this movie was directed by Brian De Palma?
Probably good as hell.
Because, like, I'm thinking, like, this movie does give a lot of blowout energy. Mm-hmm. Like, potential.
No, if Brian De Palma directed this, would be good as hell.
Yeah, like, because, like...
It would make sense, probably.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm already, like, especially when he's, like, that cutting scene where he's, like, editing through all the footage and we get all the various, like, screens and stuff. Like, I'm thinking, like, oh, this is, like, very, like, Brian De Palma coded a little bit from, like blowout as he's, like, going through, like, all the audio tapes and files. And it is kind of in that same way of, like, a person who goes through video footage, spots a crime.
Yeah.
And then... through their craft, investigates it further. And it's like, this has like Brian De Palma's name written all over it.
Except Robin Williams.
I didn't even think about the blowout connection. Yeah. It does have similarities to it.
Yeah, right?
Except the crime ends up not being important.
I was just about to say
that's
that.
He witnesses the
crime and then doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah, doesn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And at the end, he's like, did you forgive your dad? And she's like, yeah. Like, what?
As an editor, when I was watching that montage, I was just like, I don't know how you show people editing in movies. The only thing, I don't have a solution.
The same way you show people hacking in the Swordfish.
Yes.
But like a fundamental issue, I think, with this movie is like, I get to like minute 55. I'm like, I have to watch this movie kind of in a few little like increments. Yeah. And so I look at about 55 minutes, there's like 40 left.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh. I feel like the plot hasn't even started.
It doesn't start literally until the point of no return.
Yeah.
Basically the plot starts
an hour and 10 minutes in. Because like this whole time it's just Robin Williams like kind of like sulking about between a few different like areas.
Yeah, he's sad here. He's sad there.
Yeah, Jim Caviezel's like, give me the tapes. He's like, no. I'm like, okay. And then he's hanging out with Delia. And
also,
then
he
he's
turns
down
$500,000 for those tapes, by the way.
Yeah.
Another piece of evidence maybe that,
he's that
Robin Williams just doesn't need
He doesn't
money.
Care about money.
Yeah.
And then he is like, you know, hanging out with Delia. He is meeting with other cutters and he's just trying to find Lewis.
Yeah.
And those are the main things we're kind of jumping between until the plot finally fucking starts. He has a crash out with Delia.
Mm-hmm. She finds his gun.
She finds his gun because he breaks into I-Corp to check and see if Lewis had an implant so he could like
with
watch his
the assistant. Who brought up the sorting program.
Yes.
So this guy appears three times in this movie.
Yes, this is one of three.
And all he does, and I mean, I guess that's what characters do, right? Is push the plot forward. But he literally like, you know what I mean? Like, I know it's a dumb thing to say.
Getting into the basics of storytelling, characters push the plot forward
but it's
is
just
so
like,
funny.
Like, I'm struggling to find the value of having two assistants in this movie.
There is none.
When you only need one to really
it's
get
first,
anything done.
It's first draft type shit.
And like, I know that this guy is created literally to like cause three specific plot events.
Yeah.
But that's literally all he does. He's not even in the background of the shots.
I always find it funny when there's a character who's in a movie purely as a plot device.
Yeah.
My favorite example of this is General Grievous, a character who exists purely to like propel the plot.
To be cool.
The second, literally, it is 2 minutes between. Okay, Darth Vader's in the movie now, and General Grievous getting shot. They're like, the second we don't need this guy anymore, he is out of the picture.
Yes.
But he says his cousin works at iTech, a company that does not believe, that will store all of your memories digitally and all of its files physically. He does mention the security guard, the cousin of the assistant.
Right, because earlier in the movie, when he has to go pick up the footage, he has to go to like a vault.
Yes. And they give and then and when he like, goes back, he goes to this dark room, and the security guard is like, you can't use the computer because they flag all searches. So like, okay, that's explained away or whatever. But then they just have like rows upon rows. There's been 9 generations of the Zoe device. There must be millions of these records.
Where do you get that information that there's 9 generations?
He says it. He says at one point they say
the Zoe. You watched this movie twice.
Folks, I watched this movie
2 times.
At one point he says, we're currently on, he's like, oh, we're on the 9th generation. So he's Lewis about the same age as me. So he probably was using a Zoe 1500. And all of this is like delivered really quickly. I understand how you missed it.
Yeah.
Because you're also kind of trying to figure out what the fuck is going. You're thinking,
what's
so
much he doing
about,
there in the first place?
What is the plot?
Yeah.
So, and then of course he, you know, after, obviously they're not going to show us 2 hours of him searching, but it is really convenient how quickly he doesn't find Lewis's record,
yeah.
how quickly he finds his own record. And then like,
but it's like L and H I J K L M N O P. Like H and L are not close.
Oh well, it's Hackman and Hunt.
Oh, it's Lewis Hunt. You're right.
So you and A.
Apparently, there's only like
maximum
25 people with H's who have the
and
Zoe.
They're both in the same box.
He's like, no,
not a lot of H's or H O's or H I's.
Yeah, just,
those don't exist.
Yeah, it goes. And what's funny is Alan Hackman is like the 4th file in. Yeah. So there are a couple of HAs ahead of him.
Yeah.
And then there's like basically 10 random files to where Hunt should be and isn't.
There's weirdly Ethan Hunt.
Ethan.
It's like
Ethan.
The implant.
Ethan. Ethan, get the big beef and cheddar at Arby's.
I think.
Ethan.
Why are you going?
Ethan, get the French dip at Arby's.
Stop.
I'm saying we should combine the Ving Rhames, Arby's, and the Ving Rhames Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
I do think, and this could be not true, but I do think I've mentioned Mission Impossible on every version of the podcast
it's good.
I've been on. So
it's important.
I plan on continuing that.
Good. Very good.
Ethan.
Ethan, the implant.
The thing is, if you send me a text that's like, Ethan, turn left at the stoplight, I will literally read it in Ving's voice in my head, 5.1 surround sound. I will just hear it, his voice.
The low bass of his voice.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Delia shoots... She talks earlier in the movie and she says that she went to her ex-boyfriend's memory and she didn't like it because she wanted to remember him the way she understood him, not the way that some guy who doesn't know her.
Robin is like a broken person, makes her a cut of just like her with her ex-boyfriend, right?
No.
Oh, that's not what happens.
No. She finds his like, his cut, and she finds what I think she finds is a rough cut.
Oh,
of
she
his.
Finds the deleted stuff. That's right.
Yeah. So she everything. This is another weird piece of technology in this movie. It's like all technology is crystal based.
Yes,
which I think is cool.
I love crystal based tech.
Right. It's just it looks sick.
Crystal based.
When
tech.
You take
it's like in Superman when they put the crystal into the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And she like he leaves. Jim Caviezel and the goon are outside. And they're like the nameless goon who's
what is that guy's deal?
He's just angry and likes killing people. And he goes to go in and Jim Caviezel's like, no, I know that I threatened Robin Williams's life. And that I know we told him that you might kill him, but we want this to be clean. All of a sudden we're backtracking and they won't go into the apartment until Delia leaves, but she's asleep. Robin Williams comes back from getting his pause button tattoo and he discovers that she has discovered that he was the cutter behind her ex-boyfriend's memory. And in doing so, she accuses him of essentially the same thing that I think the director was trying to say all movie without any effect, that basically you're corrupting people's memories by like creating this fake version of them. She freaks out. She
pulls out a
is
gun.
A very, very, very good shot.
Yeah, she nails it.
Robin Williams, who purchases a gun illegally from information he finds in someone's rememory, also didn't watch the gun safety part of that guy's memory because he just leaves the gun out.
Yeah.
She gets enraged. She, with a perfect shot with a 6-shooter, shoots the, not the guillotine, but just the drive that holds Bannister's memory. Yeah. And we've been led to believe this whole time that this whole movie, that at some point the banister gun is going to go off.
Yeah.
Right. Like
it doesn't,
it just breaks. And then that's it. He goes to the widow and he's like, hey, you know,
we lost the marriage. She's like,
I'm sorry. Sometimes guillotines like eat footage, you know, it's like not a big deal. It
and,
just happens.
She's like,
imagine telling a client that
we lost all of your husband's memory.
Sometimes Avid just
Nexus
like
crashed,
eats your footage.
And now
we lost
your
husband's
your
entire
Oakwood
life.
Spot. Yeah.
And she's like, that's fine. I'll remember him our own way, but you're going to waive your fee. Right. And you're like, yeah, absolutely. It's like the strangest tone to that scene.
And she's like, and you're not going to tell anybody about the molestation.
Yeah.
Wink, wink. Right. It's just so fucking random.
Yeah.
Well, it's like so much of this movie is, and so little of it is driven by any true plot. Like you said, until the point of no return where he discovers he has the Zoe.
Yeah.
And, or sorry, I guess it's.
Because he decides he has to like track his own memories.
Yes.
So he goes to the other cutters and is like, I need to go back in my own memory. Like, we've only done it once and it fried someone's brain. He's like, well, it'll work with me. And it does.
My favorite part about it is it has a 5-minute limit.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, and it counts like biology down. Has a 5-minute limit is what's so funny.
Yeah. And I don't know, like it's a hard limit, which we'll discover. And I also love, I don't know why this entertained me. He sets the clock in seconds.
Yeah.
Whatever, 5 times 6 is 300. So it starts at like 300 seconds and only counts down from there.
What?
Yeah, there's a counter and it just
makes no sense when you're looking at it.
No idea. Because it's not like you would think the technology that he uses for the timer would be very similar to the technology that's used in editing. And so I get that we're not going to count time in frames.
Yeah.
But like we do count time in minutes also with movies. So like, you know, so it wouldn't have been too big of a stretch to just do 3 minutes and count down from there. It's just a strange choice that I don't understand. But it's this same assistant we were talking about earlier who's like, you know, I turned a woman's brain into jelly. And Robin Williams is like,
it'll be fine.
I'm just built different. I'm
built different guy. Like, because he enters his memories and he goes back to his childhood and discovers that that Lewis did not die.
Yes.
That he just fell, and what he thought was blood was paint on the ground. Mm-hmm. He was just traumatized in the moment. And Lewis like moved his head and he was still alive and he doesn't have to harbor the guilt of this person's death anymore.
And all of this happens because the other cutter is like, well, have you considered asking the family?
Yeah.
And the mom is just like, I don't want to talk about some random guy with big ass glasses, that four-eyed fuck. I don't want to talk about him. I only want to talk about like the nice things my husband did. And then he asked the daughter and the daughter was like, that's Lewis.
Yeah.
He's dead. Mr. Lou. D-E-D dead.
Because this movie would be more interesting or it wouldn't even be like good, but it would be more interesting if like the idea was, he asked, who is this? It's Lewis. He goes back in his memory and he realizes I didn't like.
Oh, I wonder how he survived.
Yeah. I wonder how he survived. Goes back. And then he's like, now that I don't have this guilt, I want to go talk to this person and apologize for that. And then he finds out that they're dead. Because that's a nice little like, kind of like heart-wrenching payoff to this whole storyline. It's like he won't get that moment, and he still has to live with some level of guilt that he'll never get the ability to apologize to the person again. And then he apologizes as at the grave.
Yeah,
that's the like the emotional through line of this. Because once he finds out that he's dead early on,
why does it matter that you
no
know
point
your memory?
There's
is?
No point for the rest of the investigation.
I agree. So we should have continued with Bannister. We should have exposed him.
Yeah.
And at Robin Williams, it would have been more interesting if, because Fletcher was only ever an assistant, right?
Yeah.
And he leaves. His sister watches the Zoe footage like on repeat for days of her son's death, and then she forgets who Fletcher is, and then Fletcher goes nuts because his own family doesn't recognize him, and he disappears only to reappear on the side of the anti-implant group.
Yes.
And then there's just like, so at that point it would have been more interesting if Robin Williams just like joined in the fun and was like, let's expose them. But instead we keep going down this rabbit hole of a problem we've already solved.
Yeah.
Lewis is alive. You didn't kill him.
Yeah.
What does it matter what your memory is at this point?
Yeah.
He didn't die.
Yeah.
It's funny when the movie spends like 5 minutes into any one of those plots, you forget that it's also laid the groundwork for like 8 other ones that you've completely forgotten
eight
about.
8 other ones that don't really do anything.
Because that
have the same amount of payoff as the one you're currently watching, is none.
Yes. All the bonds inexplicably like come together. He's at Lewis's grave.
Yeah.
Apologizing here, which is the correct place to end this plot line.
Sure.
But he should have learned that he was dead 2 scenes prior.
He should have gone to the grave 2 scenes prior. Yeah.
Like he should have like, it should have been like, Where is he? He's the same place he's been for 20 years. Oak Hill Cemetery. Like Back to the Future Part 2 type shit.
Yeah.
But he finds the, like, he's at the grave and Jim Caviezel comes to him.
Jim Caviezel, like, emerges stealthily from behind him.
And Robin Williams confesses, like, the tape was, it was destroyed. Like, you're never going to get the memories.
Jim Caviezel says, you know, word on the street is that a cutter got an anti-implant. An anti-implant tattoo. And, you know, hitherto, therefore, it's you. And then he whips his little gun out and he's like, I'm going to get the footage, fucker.
And probably, and like this chase ensues through the graveyard.
I wish that was the dialogue.
Through like a 30 feet by 50 foot
garbage
graveyard.
Day.
Yeah. Oh. And Robin Williams is defeated by a root in the ground. he's running along. Jim Caviezel is hip firing a pistol. And it's so weird because, like, I've seen Jim Caviezel in movies where he has a pistol.
Yeah.
And of course, everything I've seen was like after the final cut. Yeah. So maybe he didn't know.
Maybe
at the
he
time,
learned at that point.
But he's like really kind of just like running behind him with his pistol held low at his waist, missing every fucking shot. And you're like, I mean, like, there are so many easier ways to kill Robin Williams than this. And we see, you know, like bullets glancing off of gravestones, you know, little bit of like little particles of rock everywhere. And the whole, we're undone at the end when
he trips on a
roof. Robin Williams falls. Jim Caviezel has this change of heart, which is motivated by nothing.
Yeah.
Right? Seconds before, it was a chase for the Zoe implant. And now Jim Caviezel's like, all right, I'm going to shoot a gun off into the woods and you're going to just run away. Yeah. Right? We're like, great. We love to see Robin Williams.
You think it's going
to
be a Miller's Crossing type thing where he's like, leave the town.
Make like a tree and leave. Yeah. And then we hear a gunshot on a close-up of Robin Williams and we think that maybe they're going to trick us and have killed Jim Caviezel. Nope. Still Robin Williams.
Yeah.
He gets shot by the goon.
Who comes out of nowhere.
Knew the path that Robin Williams might run. And I know movies are just simply the parallel universe where all of these things played out.
Yeah.
Right? You could take a movie, put it in another universe and change one detail. Yeah. And you could do this infinitely until you get a different movie. Right? And this is just the one where this is how everything played out the way you're seeing it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is like the only way to understand
but
this
also
movie.
Like why we don't need this goon.
We don't need this goon.
Because then Jim Caviezel, like, we see Robin Williams is laying on the ground dying. We see, like, from his POV, like, the end of his Zoe memory, like, all distorted because he has the implant.
Honestly, the best part, I think, of this sequence is that the filmmakers remembered that they had put an audio blocking filter on Robin Williams. And every time it cuts to his POV, there is no sound.
Yeah, it's silent. It's good.
And you're like, okay, so somebody knew what they were doing.
Thought of a thing.
Yeah.
Because he dies. And then, like, we basically, Jim Caviezel, like, kind of looks a little sad at him. And then we cut to Jim Caviezel just, like, going through his memories, trying to find what he's looking for.
Basically being like, your death will not be in vain.
Yeah.
Like,
it's weird. And that's where the movie ends. But, like, what do you mean his death won't be in vain in terms of the movie? Like,
well, it's like he's going to scavenge his memory for the memory of Bannister.
But
yes,
it's like
exactly.
But
he
it's
wants
like,
to steal the footage. He wants to take the footage that he knows Robin Williams has watched and use it to expose the leaders of ITech.
But now we're like, so basically we're saying Robin Williams died just covering up a molestation. Like,
yes.
Like that is where the movie is ending.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
Also real quick, I do want to go back to just that scene we talked about before with the when they take the two MagSafe wireless chargers and they attach them to Robin Williams' head and that's all they need to connect to his memories.
Of course.
And like you were talking about before, Stuart, you mentioned sort of like the like parallax of cutter after cutter after cutter after cutter watching an infinite amount of footage.
Right.
Which they do, funnily enough, touch on with these two little things hooked to his head and he's like looking through the monitor and he sees
the other guy's viewpoint looking at the monitors, so it just creates like an infinity pool of monitors.
Yeah.
Just cool.
It's a fun visual.
Right at 5 minutes when he finally watches the memory and he sees that, like you said, Jeff, it was a can of paint. Yeah. He stepped in. Lewis was breathing at the end. Lewis was the instigator, not Alan. Alan is telling him to go back. It's okay. And Lewis is like, no, I'm gonna cross it. And so, like, turns out Robin Williams is just, like, the world's shittiest fucking memory.
Yeah.
But anyways, right at 5 minutes, he gets, like, his brain gets shocked.
He
gets, and he goes, and he flies back from his chair. And they're like, did we fry his brain? And he just opens his eyes and is like, I'm okay, guys. I'm just built different.
Oh, my God.
this movie just keeps introducing concepts that it's not interested in exploring.
Yeah.
Another one that
but it doesn't finish.
That I don't want to get bogged down in, but there's that part where he like shows Delia all these like, this like sometimes the implant fucks up and it creates memories that don't exist.
That gun never goes off again. Yeah, it never goes off at all.
That's the only time it's ever mentioned, because he shows her like this of someone driving and like there's a bunch of fish outside the window.
And it's honestly like, why introduce that if you're not going to say that Robin Williams' implant is defective, right?
Yeah. It's the clear, like, it's clearly a setup, and then you don't get a payoff. Like, screenwriting is nothing if not setup and payoff.
Which is why I think there's 30 minutes, an hour of footage lying somewhere.
That you could just add into this movie.
Yeah, and I wonder how bad the movie was with it.
Probably just like really slow. And even though it had more content.
Or there's like the part of it, it's like, what if this was like a 100-page script and they're like, you got 35 days to film it? Because Omar Naim did say they shot this in 35 days. Like, what if they say you have 35 days and he had to like cut a bunch of things from the script to film it?
There's no way this was like, that just adds to my point. This just, there has
not,
to be more
this
footage.
Is not a final movie.
Yeah.
It's not the final cut. It is, in fact,
it is not the
it
final
does not feel
cut.
Like the final cut of this movie.
I was thinking about that when I was watching it. Like, I was like, there's clearly so much more work that needs to be done. I know that they're
it's
not.
Funny
I know
it's
that it's
the
not
final
a meta
cut.
Representation of itself, but I'm like, this very clearly is an unpolished version.
Yeah.
It's
even now from the script, though, the script feels very first drafty, too.
And it's just, like, this movie would be good if it was written better, which is why, like, the Secret Life of You work, or Secret History of You from Black Mirror works so well.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting and there are stakes. And
there's no stakes in this until suddenly Rob Williams is shot.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Like, there's nothing drives the plot forward except for Robin Williams doing things.
Yes. Which is not, you know.
And he's not motivated, I feel like, to do half of the things that he's doing.
Yeah.
Which is why, like, a movie like Strange Days or The Secret History of You is a better execution of this movie.
Yeah. Oh, also, why does Fletcher take the necklace off of the... Robin Williams, after years, he takes... When Lewis first falls, the necklace gets stuck on a nail. And so Alan takes it, holds onto it for, like, his entire life. Finally visits Lewis at the grave, puts the necklace back, the shark tooth necklace back, and then Jim Caviezel takes it.
Yeah.
The movie ends with a shot of the necklace around Jim Caviezel's neck while he's saying,
unclear.
Yeah, your sacrifice will not be in vain.
Unclear. Unexplained.
So what do you think this movie's about? What was he trying to say?
I have no idea. I think he's just he's trying to tell a tale of like...
Two cities. I
don't know. Good book. I truly don't know what the intended goal of this movie is.
I feel like, and maybe not every movie is made with a message, but I feel like every filmmaker intrinsically has a message they're putting into their work.
They have an idea.
And usually I can figure out like what they were thinking about when they made a movie. And in this one, I'm like, what is he commenting on? Is he commenting on
filmmaking? Is he commenting on surveillance?
On the corruption of your memory?
Is it about living in the past?
Yeah.
It is essentially about all these things and yet none of them.
Yeah, it's about them, but it doesn't... I feel like...
it's a surface-level interpretation.
It's like he's raising issues and then refuses to explore... He's like, these are all the things that I think about, right? I think about memory, but he doesn't really ever explore memory.
Yeah,
right.
He doesn't really explore the ramifications of thinking that you killed your friend, right?
Yeah.
It's like such a, like it haunts him and it's such a major part of what Robin Williams' character thinks about. And yet, I'm like, what are you saying about it? Like,
what are you saying about the character? Because if Robin Williams feels guilty about maybe causing his friend to die, but then doesn't blink twice when he thinks one of his clients might have molested their daughter.
Yeah.
Like, it's diametrically opposed. So I don't know if I should be sympathetically viewing Robin or unsympathetically viewing Robin.
Like, I do feel like the safe bet generally is just to be sympathetic, right? Is to be like...
But
I don't know if that's the answer to this movie. Yeah. I'm like, I sympathize with Robin Williams simply because you told me he was the main character, right? And I that's what I think is really interesting about shows, like even like Breaking Bad, right? Like, Walter White is a terrible fucking guy.
Yeah, and you, but he's compelling.
But it's in his, it's his story. So like, you kind of want him to win. Yeah. A little bit, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's what's interesting about the tension of those stories.
Yeah,
there's no tension in this
at all. Yeah,
it just deflates before you.
And then like, you know, that final scene where he's being chased by Jim Caviezel. It's like the second ending to a movie that I thought was ending.
Yes,
right. And it's like, oh, I forgot about this plot point. Like, and we're all of a sudden we're like chasing you through a cemetery, you know. I guess I just like, when I watch this movie, I don't leave with it thinking
about anything
about the implications of
I watch and I think, what was the point of that?
Yeah. Why did I spend 90 minutes watching it? Why have I spent 90 minutes watching it four times in my life? The world may never know.
And now we've spent 94 minutes talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really good, like, kind of like outro summary a little bit about our thoughts, because, and which carries into the post text, because the movie comes out. I could not find budget numbers on this movie, but I think we all agree it's like very low budget, but the box office is probably even lower.
It makes $3.6 million.
I was like, it feels like a $5 to $10 million movie, right?
Oh, I don't even know about
you. Don't think
that.
It's that high?
No,
I guess it's 2004. So
I would say five. It's probably $5 million
movie. Yeah,
maybe less.
No marketing at all.
Yeah.
No.
Or sorry, the bare minimum of marketing.
Yeah.
Because I don't even know how you would market this movie. And I mean, I think I just stumbled upon it. I must have been.
It's like, who's this movie for? Like,
it's for me.
It's for editors of the world unite.
It's for nobody, but yet it's also for Sam.
Yeah. And thank you. It's a bad movie that does not at all answer anything. It doesn't comment at all on editing. You know what I mean? Like, it makes a couple of loose things about how editors change the context or can change the context. Yeah. And maybe that's what the movie
is
about.
Point, like, you remember, half-baked ideas.
You remember the finale of Blowout where it's like, we start the movie thinking like we get to know about this post sound audio technician guy. And the movie does a great job of like having his profession be like the pushing of the plot. And then the payoff to that is the climax is he's listening to her wireless microphone. Yes. And it's like, that's what this movie is ostensibly trying to do. That's the projectile this movie needs, is it needs that thing to like, what about this guy's job and this concept is going to push the story forward? Mm-hmm. And it very clearly just does not care about that.
Yeah.
So I see you taking your headphones off because I know you got to get going.
I do got to split.
Okay. Let's close
If you guys
out.
Want to talk, I can split and you guys can wrap Sam's up.
We can wrap. I don't have anything left to say.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you so much, Sam, for coming on.
Sorry to cut it off.
Anything you want to plug before we go?
Oh, yeah. No, not at all. I'm excited to be here. Can't wait to come back. What's the next one?
We'll tell you. We'll talk about it.
Hot.
Yeah. This is the last episode for 2025. Next time you'll be hearing us is the next year, 2026. Yeah.
2026.
Thank you so much for listening,
year.
Everybody, to the final cut. If you like this episode, please remember to become a like, subscribe, whatever platform you're listening on. Remember, we're available on whatever platform you get your podcast from. Thank you all so much to Rebecca for the graphic design, Michael Vivian Smith for the theme music. See you all next week in the new year for House of D.